I think we're good here. All right, in our study so far, we left off last week. Our friend Laban had gone north. He was getting out of town for a little while because he had offended his brother to such an extent that the brother decided he's going to kill him. At least that was what he said. And so Laban headed up north here from where he was. He was down here in Beersheba area. He goes all the way up north to Haran up there, about a 400 or 500 mile jaunt, to stay with good old Uncle Laban for a little while. Rebekah's brother, we saw him before, and we kind of know a little bit about his character, and so we might not have been shocked out of our mind to see some deception on good old Uncle Laban's part of Jacob. So he goes up there and wants to marry one of Laban's daughters by name Rachel. But Laban pulls a trick on him and slips his older daughter in place of Rachel, and he ends up then with two wives and their concubines. So he now has Leah and Rachel, and there they are right there on your, this is your scorecard thingy. There's the wives right there, Leah, the older daughter, Rachel, the one he really wanted, and both of their handmaids, Bilhah and Zilpah. So this family now has begun with four wives and Jacob. And they start having the baby wars, fighting over who's going to be who and who's going to mother who and so on. And Leah has all of these guys right here. Six sons and a daughter. The handmaids each have two there, and well, here's those two and those two. And Rachel has had one so far in our study, that's Joseph. Benjamin's not on the scene yet, he comes later. So the family has grown now through all this turmoil that we saw earlier into 11 sons and one daughter. What's the chances, humanly speaking, of 11 births out of 12 being males, and just one daughter? Does that sound like human odds to you, since the male sperm has a 50-50 chance of being a male or female? So how come it is 11 out of 12 were males? Because obviously God's in control. God controls the birthing process. He controls the sex of the child. And as you can see there, he wanted to build this nation into 12 sons and one daughter. And he's got 11 out of the 12 boys so far in place. And the daughter, Dinah, she'll be a player as we go on into the next chapter two. Right now she's getting no press and nothing's going on with her. But she will. Okay, so now that's the scene. When we pick up our study in 30:25, Genesis chapter 30, verse 25, 14 years later now, it came about when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my place and to my own country." He said, "Look, it's time for me to go. I've got a family built up here. It's time for me to get on out of here and go back to where I came from. Give me my wives and my children, whom I have served you, for whom I have served you, and let me depart. For you know yourself my service which I have rendered to you." In other words, it's time for me to go, and I've done a good job for you while I've been up here. But Laban said to him, "Well, if it now pleases you, stay with me. I have divined that the Lord has blessed me on your account." Now clearly Laban is still tinkering around in idolatry in various forms. He's a diviner. And he concludes that, wait a minute now, your God has blessed me while you have been with me, so I want you to stay. And he continued, "Name me your wages and I will give it." Yeah, you want to take that to the bank? That promise? That'd be a little suspicious if I was Jacob. And he said to him, "You yourself know how I've served you and how your cattle have fared with me. For you had little before I came, and it has increased to a multitude, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned. But now, when shall I also provide for my own household also?" So Jacob is concerned. And look, he's got to provide for this large growing family that he has that will turn into a nation, the nation Israel. He's got to make some money on his own. So Laban says, "Well, what shall I give you?" And Jacob says, "You shall not give me anything." If you will do this one thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flock. So I'm not asking for a handout here, but if we make a right kind of arrangement, I will work for you still, managing your resources, these animals, these flocks of animals. Here's the plan that Jacob puts forward. Let me pass through your entire flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted sheep, and every black one among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and such shall be my wages. So Jacob says, look, let me go cull out of your flocks the abnormally colored animals, the unusual births, and I'll use that for my starter herd, and that will be my payment. I'll go from there, and you can have all of the regular, normal animals. So that's the plan. He says, so my honesty will answer for me later when you come concerning my wages. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs is found with me will be considered stolen. So he says, look, you can tell which is yours and which is not easy enough by just looking at them. All of my animals going forward will be these odd colored ones that is abnormal, an abnormal birth among the animals there. And Laban liked that idea, verse 34. He says, well, let it be according to your word. And look what this snake does, verse 35. So he, that is Laban, removed on that day the striped and spotted male goats and the speckled and spotted female goats, everyone with white on it, and all the black ones from among the sheep, and gave them into the care of his sons. And he put a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. And Jacob fed the rest of Laban's stock. So what's the guy do? He goes out and culls out of his animals all of what Jacob would use as the starter herd. He takes all of those odd colored animals and separates them out and takes them 3 days away from Jacob so he can't even get to them. So that rat takes all of what Jacob needed for starting his herd and hides it away from him. Good old Uncle Laman. Once again, the deceiver got deceived. And so Jacob starts taking care of then the rest of the flock. So he probably was real disappointed when he goes out there and can't cull out much of anything as a starter herd because they'd already been taken and hid from him by Laban. So what does he do? Well, he uses some techniques of selective breeding that I don't know if there's anything to this or not. You guys that know how to ranch and stuff, you might know more about this than I do, but I don't think there's a lot to this. I think it's just like God's hand in all this. But at any rate, what he does is he uses some techniques. He takes the fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees, and he peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white which was in the rods. And so he makes some what looks like striped rods from peeling the bark off of certain trees. And he set the rods which he had peeled in front of the flocks of the gutters, even in the watering troughs, where the flocks came to drink, and they mated when they came to drink. So he's got these suggestive signs sitting all around the watering trough. And so when the animals come to water, they see these suggestive strips of trees that he's put in place there, and they mate with those things around. Sound to you like anything that actually works? I don't know. Yeah, as I say, you ranchers tell me. I don't think it does, but at any rate, he does this. So the flocks mated by the rods, and the flocks brought forth striped, speckled, and spotted. Well, it worked, but I think God's hand is in the whole process here. And so God starts to bless Jacob with these odd-colored critters. And he's building him up a herd. And Jacob separated the lambs, and he made the flocks face toward the striped and all the black in the flock of Laban. And he put his own herds apart and did not put them with Laban's flock. So again, he has them faces in certain directions, and he separated his own out. Things that I don't think matter, but God blessed him nevertheless. So moreover, it came about when the stronger of the flock was mating that Jacob would place the rods in the side of the flock in the gutter so that they might mate by the rods. And when the flock was feeble, he did not put them in, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. So the man became exceedingly prosperous, and he had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. And this infant nation is now starting to grow. He now has a bunch of livestock, a bunch of material wealth in that day in the form of animals. as a result of, I think, God's blessing on him, but he thinks it's maybe a result of selective breeding using these various techniques that he used here. So, the nation is starting to take shape. So far, it consists of Jacob, four wives, well, two wives and two handmaids, four women, kind of like wives, and 12 children. And he's now got bunches of animals. He's probably adding servants, females and male servants, camels, donkeys. I mean, he's just really growing as a nation. So the time he spent up there, which will amount to about 20 years, he grows from essentially nothing. Remember, all he had when he went up there, he says later, is his staff. He had a walking stick. That's what he went up there with. And he comes back now with all of this family and animals and all of this stuff. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the trip down to Egypt, doesn't it? They go down there with not much, and they come out with a lot because they take it from the Egyptians on the way out. And it's sort of a preview of that sort of thing going on. And he's doing well, and he's growing. Chapter 31, now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our fathers he has made all his wealth. The sons of Laban aren't real happy with Jacob. They don't like the fact that Jacob has been so successful in building his herds, and that Laban hasn't been successful. And so there's bad blood brewing now between Jacob and Laban's family. So he knows it's time to go. He saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Again, kind of reminds me, there was a Pharaoh arose in Egypt who knew not Joseph, and they started persecuting and dumping on the fledgling nation there, didn't it? The same sort of thing starting to happen here. Bad blood developing between them. So then the Lord says to Jacob, verse 3, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. Now remember, God appeared to him before, and he told him, he said, I will be with you wherever you go, and I will bring you back into the land of your fathers. Well, here he repeats it to Jacob and tells him to get on back to where he came from, and God would be with him and bless him in that process. So he has God's assurances that the trip back will be successful. So he sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field. And that's kind of unusual in and of itself. And he actually consults his wives. Usually they don't get to even vote on anything. But he gets his wives out there and he says to them, look, I see your father's attitude. It's not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my fathers has been with me. And you know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. So he kind of recounts for them what's happened here. He may think he's going to have to convince them of something, but we'll see here that not a whole lot of convincing is needed here. If he spoke thus, the speckles shall be your wages, and all the flock brought forth speckles. And if he spoke thus, the stripes shall be your wages, and all the flock brought forth striped. In other words, God helped me to do this. Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and giving them to me. So as Jacob has grown in wealth, Laban has decreased in wealth. And a lot of Laban's original wealth has been transferred now to Jacob. And of course, the boys who are to inherit all that, they're not real thrilled with that. And it came about the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and I saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and molted. And the angel of the God said to me in the dream, Jacob. And I said, here I am. He said, lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and molted, for I've seen all that Laban has been doing to you. God is fully aware of what's going on here. He's fully aware of every incident in your life. If you don't think that's true, read Psalm 139 again. He formed you in your mother's womb. Everything about you he knows. And of course he knew what Laban was doing to Jacob here. And so he reminds Jacob that he's fully cognizant of everything. Omniscient. Knows it all. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. Now, God reminds him that they'd met before, and this was the if-then incident back in chapter 28, where God appeared to Jacob. He said, I'll take care of you. I'm going to lead you up here, and I'm going to lead you back. And Jacob said, well, if you will do this, then I will follow you, and not really displaying a great deal of faith there. But he added that vow to what God had said, and that's what God's referring to here. Genesis 28:20 is what he's referring to here in verse 13. So Rachel and Leah, after hearing this recount, said to him, well, do we have any portion in our inheritance in our father's house? In other words, is there anything left for us here? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us and has also entirely consumed our purchase price. So the dowry that Jacob offered to pay the work and all that, they say, well, look, he's just kind of blown that. Laban's just blown all that off anyway. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our fathers belongs to us and our children. So now then, do whatever God has said to you. So the wives are in lockstep with Jacob. They understand what he's saying. They understand they've been treated like chattel from their father. And there's nothing left for them there anyway. And they feel like the wealth that Jacob has accumulated at Laban's expense is theirs rightfully anyway. So he's not having to twist the girls' arms here very much. They recognize that whatever God has said to you, you do that. So they fall in line with him and are perfectly willing to leave and to go with him back to his homeland. It's new to them, but not new to him. It's interesting they have at least enough insight to see the hand of God at work and be willing to follow that. He didn't have to convince them that God was overseeing his life. They understood it as he told it to them. So, the camp is in agreement. We're getting out of here, is the plan. So Jacob arose, and he put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered, his acquired livestock which he had gathered in Padan Aram, that's Syria, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. So the plan was to head back toward where Isaac was back in Palestine, today Israel, down there near Beersheba. We'll see whether that works out or not. So when Laban had gone to shear his flock, so he's away, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. Yikes. What's going on here, Rachel? Why in the world does she want these things? Well, you just have to try to guess it. Explanations. It appears that maybe somehow or another she's still using them a little bit, still referring to them, still divining by using them. It looks like maybe she hasn't completely separated herself from a little idol worship here. Can't say for sure, but that looks like the case. Other guys offer an explanation. Well, maybe she thought she needed them to actually get any inheritance at all from Laban later, but doesn't appear he has the mind to give her any anyway. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. So it just looks like maybe she's still got a little bit of idolatry left in her thinking, and so she wanted these idols. Apparently they were smallish. I'm thinking, you know, maybe something about this size here, because the way she's going to hide them, they're not great big full-size models or anything like that, but some smallish idols. And so while he's gone, she takes them. And so Jacob then deceives Laban, verse 20, by not telling him where he was fleeing. Now this guy has still not quite divorced himself either from the fine art of deception, has he? He's still using that practice in his dealings with men. So he doesn't tell good old Uncle Laban, and he just loads up and moves them out. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the Euphrates River. Remember, it goes way up north there where he was. Let's show you here on the old map of Rooney again. He's up here. And here's the Euphrates River right here. So he comes down, he crosses it, and he's going to come down this side of the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan, to get down to here. So he crosses the Euphrates and heads down south here. I gather that maybe up there in toward the headwaters of it, it's not that deep or something that you can ford it. Maybe the time of year you can ford it, and other times you cannot. But whatever the case, he gets across that thing. That's not a barrier for him. And he heads down, sets his face toward the hill country of Gilead. Let me show you where that is. So he's headed down. Down here on again on the east side of the Jordan. He's headed down to right in through here. This is Gilead in through here. So he's going to come down this side, working his way down to here before he crosses into the promised land somewhere. So he's kind of right around in through here, okay? See where he's at? All right. So he's heading south on the east side of the Jordan. And so when it was told to Laban, verse 22 of chapter 31, when it was told to Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, remember, he'd called out these animals and moved them 3 days' journey away, so apparently he's shearing his sheep over there wherever he took them. And so it takes about 3 days for the message to get from Jacob's camp over to Laban. So he finds out in 3 days, he took his kinsman with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey. So he heads on down and tries to overtake him in the hill country of Gilead. So he catches up with him after about seven more days down there in Gilead over on the east side of the Jordan. And unbeknownst to Jacob, God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream of the night and said to him, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad." Do we always know when God is intervening on our behalf? Probably about, I don't know, 3/4 of the time we don't know. Jacob didn't know that God was appearing to Laban and telling Laban, "You watch your mouth, don't you even say anything to him that's bad." So, unbeknownst to Jacob, God intervenes on his behalf to protect him and to take care of him in this confrontation with Laban. Oftentimes, I think that probably is the case in our lives. We don't even know when God is doing something. Something just works out well, and maybe we learn later, well, look at God's hand in that. He must have done this, or he must have done that. And things work out well. So we don't always know that God is doing this on our behalf, but we can rest assured that he is superintending our lives at all times. Again, there's nothing about your life that he doesn't know about. He knows the number of hairs on your head. So he can know you inside and out, and does. And so rest assured that his oversight and care of your life is continuous as a child of God. So he tells Laban, "Don't you even threaten him or anything like that." So Laban catches up with Jacob, verse 25. And Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. So he caught up with him there where we showed you there on the map a while ago. So then Laban says to Jacob, he catches up with him, confronts him, and says, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs and timbrel and with lyre? Hey, we'd had a party if you told me this. But you didn't tell me, so I couldn't celebrate your departure. And you just snuck away." And he acts indignant, like he's all bent out of shape now that Jacob takes his wives, which are his wives, and treats them like captives. When in reality, you know exactly why a guy's saying what he is. They wouldn't have given him no going away party. Would have tried to persuade him to stay. Probably would have taken back his animals and done something else like that. "And you didn't allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done very foolishly." Yeah, right. It's in my power to do you harm. But, and he tells him then this incident, but the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob. How many times do you think in the world, the loss of the world, the godless, benefit because of God's blessing on the godly? Why do you think God's judgment on this nation of ours, this Christ-rejecting nation of ours that is decaying morally at some kind of warp speed, why isn't that greater than it is? Well, who's here? The church is here, isn't it? The body of Christ is here. Believers are here. And I think the presence of the believers in this country, which I guess is getting smaller all the time, percentage-wise, I think is probably why this nation hasn't been judged more severely than it has, because it surely deserves it. We're becoming a godless nation, trying to separate God from our national life in every way we possibly can, and yet we still receive His blessings. We still have the highest standard of living on the planet. And I think it's the same principle you see here, that Laban was spared by God because of Jacob. And he says, well, I got power to put the hurt on you here if I wanted to. But your God spoke to me and he said, do not. So I'm limited in what I can do, he's saying. And now you have indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. That's okay, I'll accept that. But why did you steal my gods? And Jacob is probably, his jaw probably hitting the ground. He's saying, what the heck are you talking about, Laban? I didn't steal your lousy gods. Don't need them, don't want them. I have nothing to do with that. And he's probably pretty indignant. And he says back in verse 31, well, I left because I was afraid. For I said, lest you would take your daughters from me by force. And he probably had good reason to think that way. Now, he's also got good reason to recognize God is going to protect him because God said he was going to. This man's faith is not just flying off the pages and hitting us between the eyes here. God told him he was going to take care of him and provide for him and all of that. And yet Jacob still is using those old human techniques of sneaking around and trying to deceive and all this kind of thing. So his faith is not yet built up much. The one, and then he makes this rash statement in verse 32, the one with whom you find the gods shall not live. Probably ought not to be quite that rash. I mean, if you want to make some kind of a promise or some kind of an oath, okay, but be careful and don't go completely nuts here, because he doesn't know really what's going on. If you find these gods, that person shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen him. Yikes. What if Laban finds them? Is he going to deliver up his wife? The one he really wanted the most anyway? Is he going to fulfill that rash vow? Better not to make rash vows than to make them and then not be able to fulfill them, because he doesn't know what's going on here. So Laban searches the place. He went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maids, and he couldn't find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Uh-oh. This is when the music builds up louder and louder in this plot. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt through all his tent, but he did not find him. She's got them in the saddlebags, the camel saddlebags, and she's sitting on the camel's saddlebags on the ground. Probably has on a skirt, probably covering most of the saddlebags. He may not even could have seen the saddlebags, I don't know. And he's looking all around the place, and he can't find them. And apparently he's looking over toward her now or whatever. And she says to her father, let not my Lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me. So he searched but did not find the household idols. So she uses her menstrual period as an excuse for not getting up. And she's sitting on the hiding place. Sneaky. This whole family is good at this, aren't they? She's good. Jacob's good. Everybody's good. So she foxes out old dad here. He doesn't find these idols, thankfully, because of that rash vow that Jacob made. So when it appears that he has been wrongly accused, Jacob vents back now on Laban, verse 36. He became angry, and he contended with Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what you have found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen so that we may decide between us." Let's see what you found, guy. Set it right out here and we'll let all of our relatives decide which one of us is the most noble in this deal. "These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn of beasts, I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was by day, the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from me. 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. And if the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been before me, surely now you have sent me away empty-handed after all that work for 20 years. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he has rendered judgment last night." So Jacob uses the opportunity to blast old Laban a good one. He gives him a couple earfuls. He said, "Look, I worked for you for all this time, and it wasn't fair and equitable even during all that time, and now you accuse me of this kind of thing." And so he gets a good parting shot in here at good old Uncle Laban, and it was all deserved for sure. So then Laban answers back and he says, "Well, the daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are all my flocks. All that you see is mine." Well, that ain't true. He made the deal. He's just a no-count lowlife. "But what can I do to this day, to these my daughters or to the children to whom I have born?" He said, "Well, this stuff all belongs to me, Jacob, but I can't take it back. So now let's make a covenant, you and I. Let it be a witness between you and me." So since he knows he's been, in essence, defeated, he's been had, Laban wants to build in a covenant between the two. Sort of a face-saving action here, I think, more than anything else. So Jacob took a stone and he set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jegershad Ahuda or something like that. That's Aramaic. And Jacob called it Galeed. I got a little closer on the Hebrew there. Galeed is the Hebrew name for the same place. Heap of witness is what it means. So apparently they spoke Aramaic up there in Syria where Laban was. And I gather that Jacob knew Aramaic. But he speaks Hebrew when he wants to say something, and that's what he did. So they named it the same thing, but in two different languages. And Laban said, "Well, this heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore, it was named Galeed and Mizpah, which means the same thing. Actually, Mizpah means watchtower. So it was something that it was figuratively watching over these two guys to make sure they didn't double cross each other. So they named it Mizpah and says, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we're absent from one another." In other words, when I turn my back on you, I want God watching you. And Laban says, "Well, if you mistreat my daughters," like he didn't, foisting one onto Jacob. By the way, I wonder where Rachel was that night. He probably had her locked in a basement, huh? And Leah, I suppose, went along with it because she knew she didn't have much of a chance. But how did he get Rachel to keep her mouth shut and not come screaming in there? He had to lock her away somewhere, didn't he? So it says, "If you mistreat my daughters," as though he never would, And if you take wives besides my daughters, though no man is with us, God is witness between you and me. Like somehow or another, he's really protecting the daughters now from harm or mistreatment because of his benevolence. And Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold the pillar which I've set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and pillar to me for harm. So it's a mutual non-harm pact. And the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the God of their father judged between us. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal. They ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. And early in, this would be the mountains of Gilead in there. And early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. And Laban departed and returned to his place. And thankfully, we don't hear anything more from this guy. He is off the biblical scene. And none of us, I think, have any regrets for that. So Laban is now gone. He was a rather unappealing character, but God used him and the setting up there to build this infant nation into the base there of Jacob, his wives, and his children. All that took place at the accompaniment of this guy, and God blessed Jacob with much of Laban's assets and resources into the beginning of the nation there. So the whole time up there was preparatory for the nation. Again, similar to the stay down in Egypt. Egypt was kind of like an incubator for this infant nation where they grew strong in numbers and they actually came out of there with a lot of material goods. Sort of like what happened here with Laban and Jacob. All right, chapter 32. We still got the problem of Esau, don't we? Well, God's going to take care of that next. He got him separated from Laban. Now he's going to get him reconciled and separated from Esau. Now, as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. You know, Jacob is not real confident yet in his walk with God. He's not very faithful just yet, probably concerned and worried. And so God sends this assuring revelation of these angels that is that are accompanying Jacob and his entourage. So Jacob, when he saw them, said, this is God's camp. He seems to be of the idea that when he meets God somewhere, that's where God lives. God has to be in this one particular locale. He doesn't understand the concept of omnipresence. So he names the place with two camps, Mahanaim. He sees the angels, he thinks God lives there. And he was there. So the two camps are the camp of the angels and camp of Jacob. So he sends messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Remember where that is now? That's down south down here. See Edom down here? Now he's up here. So he sends some people down this way. Edom means red, and that's where Esau ended up settling back over in there. So he sends sort of a representative group out ahead, messengers, to Esau. And he commanded him, saying, well, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob. Now notice the relationship that he establishes with Esau. He treats Esau like his superior and treats himself as Esau's servant. That's not the way God is going to treat them. So he need not be quite so concerned here with this Esau when God has promised Jacob that he's going to take care of him. So he says, I've been staying up with Laban now, and I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my Lord that I may find favor in your sight. He's hopeful that his success in life up to this point in time will somehow ingratiate himself with Esau, and the danger and threat that he last knew about might somehow or another abate. So the messengers returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he's coming to meet you with 400 men with him. Good grief. Is that everybody in Edom? He's got a large entourage with him. Now, is he bringing that large entourage so that he can basically destroy Jacob and his camp? as we'll see before the story ends, I know that's not the reason he's got them. I think he's probably bringing them to escort Jacob on back down there. The 400 men, I don't think, is in any intent to harm him, because we'll see Esau's reaction. He no longer cares about harming Jacob. But it looks like maybe they're an escort. So he brings a whole bunch of people with him. But Jacob doesn't know what he is bringing them for. Verse 7, he was greatly afraid and distressed. Now, instead of hitting his knees and asking God what to do, he takes his usual approach of trying to come up with a plan on his own. So he divides the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two companies. He splits everything into two, so that if one of them is going to get destroyed by Esau, maybe he'll end up with something left. He says in verse 8, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. And Jacob now, he says, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who did slay to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. God has promised him that. So he now turns to God in prayer based on the promise God has made. Verse 10, he says, I'm unworthy of all the loving kindness, of all the faithfulness which you have shown me. For my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I become two companies. That's the evidence of God's blessing of his life. Came in there with nothing, goes out with a bunch of stuff. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and mothers with the children. For thou didst say, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So he reminds God of the promise that God has made, but he's still not quite relying totally on that, is he? He's still kind of using human techniques and methods here to try to somehow or another manage this situation. So he spent the night there. Then he selected from that which he had with him a present from his brother for his brother Esau. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. That's 550 animals plus an unnamed number of colts from the camels. Pocket change, right? 550 animals. That's a major herd in and of itself. And he delivered them into the hands of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between droves. So he puts them into groups, and he's going to drive these groups now down to meet Esau. Here's a bunch of animals, and here comes another bunch of animals, and here comes another bunch of animals, so that it's a wave after wave of appeasing offering to Esau by Jacob. And he commanded the one in front, saying, well, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, to whom do you belong? What are you doing? To whom do all these animals in front of you belong? You shall say, well, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he's behind us. So as each wave of gifts roll over Esau, the people moving him tell him, well, these are from Jacob. And he's coming up behind us. So here's your first 100 animals. Not bad, huh? Here's your second 100 animals and your third 100 animals. And the idea, of course, is that ultimately Esau will be appeased in his wrath toward Jacob by all of this lavish gift that he has sent in him. So he commanded also the second and the third and all those who were following the drove, saying, in this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterwards I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him, and he himself spent the night in the camp. Well, who needs to be appeasing who in this confrontation? An immoral and godless man needs to be appeased by the godly Jacob? Or should Esau be trying to appease Jacob? See, Jacob is, again, his faith is not built up to a point yet where he is willing to simply trust God, and God has told him that he's going to get him back and that he's going to take care of him. But he's trying to appease Esau. I would suggest to you that it's a rare occasion indeed that the godly need to appease the godless. We don't need their favor when Almighty God is superintending our lives and we have all the promises of God available to us, we don't need to appease the godless of this world. But that's Jacob's approach. Probably he could have just trusted God and been fine. But as we've seen before, he uses a lot of human effort here to manage his life up to this point. So he rose that same night, took his two wives and two maids and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. Okay, the Jabbok River. Come back here. Okay, the Jabbok River is this feeder river over here. See that right there? It feeds into the Jordan, running west to east here. Well, actually, it comes down here, just south of Succoth. So he's right in that area there. And he crosses over from the north to the south of that Jabbok River. And he took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. So Jacob was left alone. Verse 24 of Genesis 32. And a man wrestled with him until daybreak. What the heck? What is going on here? Jacob stays in the camp by himself at night, and all of a sudden he's wrestling with some guy. The scriptures don't tell us how this wrestling match began. It tells us how it ends. Perhaps it began as a dream, I don't know. Perhaps he transitioned from a dream into an actual wrestling match. But we know from Hosea chapter 12, verses 3 and 4, that this is the pre-incarnate Christ. This is God wrestling with Jacob in a physical wrestling match. How strange is that? Very strange, huh? Very strange experience. And he wrestled all night long until daybreak. Now, Jacob is no slouch. This guy's been ranching and farming and herding and all that kind of stuff for 20 years. He's no weakling. You don't do that kind of stuff and be a total wuss. So he's physically strong. And God allows himself to, in essence, be wrestled to a draw all night long. Man, these guys are pinning one another and wrestling around and putting all their best moves on, and Jacob will not relent. And when he saw, that is the man, which is Christ, that he had not prevailed against him, Jacob, he touched the socket of his thigh, so that the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. I guess this is the original hip replacement surgery, huh? touched his thigh and knocked his hip out of joint, or slightly out of joint at least, enough to cripple him up so that he had to give up to a certain extent. Now, he didn't give up totally, but he couldn't continue as he did. So, the Lord, after a certain point in time, then goes ahead and disables Jacob's thigh. Then he said, well, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. That is, the Lord said that. But Jacob said back, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob wants a blessing from this being. Perhaps he knows who he's wrestling with here. This is not just some average, regular guy who happened by. He wants a divine blessing from this. So the Lord asks him his name, and he said, it's Jacob. Now, names reflect character in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament. So that when a person's name is spoken, his character is represented by that name. So if you change the name, you're changing the character. Not like today where you just grab a name from some list or something. It meant something back then. So when Jacob states his name, I'm Jacob, I'm the great supplanter, I'm the great deceiver, that's me, Jacob. And the Lord says back to him, verse 28, no longer shall your name be Jacob, but Israel. Israel means he fights or persists with God. You're going to go from the supplanter, the deceiver, to being the guy who wrestles with God. That's your new name. That's your new character. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And we'll come back to that in just a second. So then Jacob asks him, well, what is your name? And he said, why are you asking me my name? You know who I am. You don't need to know my name. He never tells him because Jacob knows who it is. So he blessed Jacob there at that time. So Jacob names the place Peniel, which means I've seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Kind of a long explanation for a short name, but it means essentially that. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of the hip. This practice on the part of the Jews, they won't eat the sciatic nerve in a hip joint of meat or anything like that because of this particular incident. Now, that was never instituted in the Mosaic Law, but they decided to do it, and that's just been a practice down to this day as far as I know. What in the heck is this incident about? What is God doing wrestling with Jacob and changing his name, which in essence changes his character? Well, I think the answer is basically it is a sort of a prophetic history of Israel, because they're going to not only wrestle with men. That will be their history down through the ages. There'll be a lot of conflict between them and other nations and other peoples. But they're going to also wrestle with God. What happened to that first generation that came out of Egypt? They obey God and get along just fine with him? No, they disobeyed him so much that he let them die off. They didn't even get to enter the promised land. So their history is going to be one of wrestling with men and with God, and they're going to prevail. Nobody is ever going to destroy the nation Israel. In spite of all the attempts by all their enemies, it ain't going to happen. They will prevail because God is going to wrestle not only with them throughout their history, but for them also, because they will be the most chosen and blessed people on this planet during the millennium. And he will bless them during that time. So I think the incident, as strange as it seems to us, is one that establishes for them, that nation, that infant nation, and their leader, Jacob, the character of wrestling with men and wrestling with God throughout their history. And indeed, that has been their history. And God will bless them. He has blessed them. He will bless them again, I think, is the lesson of the incident. The reason he had to dislocate the hip is to get on out of there because the sun was coming up, and apparently he didn't want Jacob to see him because of that threat that anybody that sees God will die. You can't see his face and live. And so he wanted to get on out way in the dark. So he puts that little hip displacement on him, and he limps in, I guess, the rest of his life. So he comes out of this incident with two new things, a blessing from God and a limp. One he probably would like to have, the other not so much. So I think that's probably what this incident is all about, is to prophetically foreshadow the spiritual conflict that this nation will go through. Remember what Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 6? We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces. The invisible creation that Christ made is at war with the visible creation where we live. The evil forces in the invisible world are trying to destroy those of us in the visible world that follow Christ. It is a wrestling, Paul talks about, and it is with spiritual beings. It's not with other men. It's with those evil minions of Satan that want to take over and control the physical creation. So it is a wrestling, spiritual wrestling match that we're involved in here. And I think this incident probably foreshadows that very thing. Any questions or comments about anything we saw here this morning? Jacob loads him up and moves him out of here and comes back home. God meets him and tells him he's going to take care of him all the way. Has resolved the problem with Laban. Has appeared to him here now in this incident. And next time we'll see he will also resolve the problem with Esau. Any questions or comments about any of this? You guys are good. You absorb anything I say. Whether it makes sense or not. And usually doesn't. All righty. We'll let you roll. Be sure and get you a roster back there if you haven't got one yet. We'll bring some more next week to get them to everybody. And we will see you next Thursday, Lord willing.